Well, welcome back to the Burrows of Berea. And boy, do I have a treat for you. This is a guest that I've been wanting to talk to pretty much ever since I saw the movie Collision. I grew up in an atheist family, and so the hitch slap was a normal thing that we heard about with Christopher Hitchens. And so I get to meet the director today, and so do you, director, filmmaker Darren Doan. Thanks for being on the podcast.
I'm fired up, man. This is,
man,
I love this stuff. So let's go deep. Let's go skinny branches, or let's just rock, whatever you want to do. Let's just get after it.
Yeah. And so for those of you who are watching, you just saw my intro where I told you all about Darren's accomplishments. What a career. My goodness. You were integral in the punk scene in the mid 90s.
Yeah, no, it was crazy. I mean, you know, right place, right time, you know, proximity is it really, you know, you think about it, you know, someone's got an advantage somewhere based on proximity. It just depends if it fits for you, right? If you're growing up in, you know, 1950s Detroit and you like cars, I'm assuming that was, there was probably something that just, you know, and for me, it was the suburbs, Southern California, being, you know, 30 miles outside of Los Angeles and Hollywood, music industry, film industry, that kind of proximity, you know, it made you think everything was sort of possible. You know, you saw rock stars, you saw actors. The town I lived in, you would be driving and you'd see Arnold Schwarzenegger, or, you know, Will Smith, or Shaquille O'Neal, you know, like it was, or Wayne Gretzky. It was just, you know, when you live in an area that you see that sort of stuff, it doesn't feel like it's that, you know, hard to do, although it is. But mentally you're like, ah, he's right there. He's a person. And all my friends were in bands, and it just seemed like, you know, we can do this.
Yeah. That's, I mean, got a camera and just went to it, which is awesome.
Exactly. Yeah. You know, it was, you know, my brother's 7 years older than me, and we were always getting into wild stuff. And I was sort of, you know, the kid with the camera and, you know, hanging out of the car while they were taking baseball bats to, you know, mailboxes, and I'm the kid trying to film it, you know, and you learn quickly that you know, want to be actually in the front filming backwards. You don't want to be in the back and having to come the other way. And, you know, and your friends are in bands and you're filming them at backyard parties, and it's wild. And it's like any other kind of high school party in a very, you know, maybe non-Christian environment for those who didn't, you know, who weren't raised, you know, in a Christian environment, and there's fights and things happen. And you just sort of get used to creating and chaos and energy and a little bit of violence. And so it all sort of creates this energy that you can just do things.
Mm-hmm. And I noticed, you know, because once I learned that about you, I wanted to go back, because a lot of those videos I had seen, because I'm a 90s kid, right? I graduated in 1993. And so I'm, you know, out and about and listening to this music too. And I go back and I look at these videos, like, oh my goodness, this was the guy that was doing that. Like, it's so wild that, you know, that you caught that scene and captured it. And you really did. You made Blink, you put, you know, that work put them on the map, and it really did do a lot for them, which I thought was incredible.
Yeah. You know, it says something about, again, about sort of opportunities, you know, I mean, Blink would have found somebody, right? And it probably would have been someone who either had been doing maybe music videos for a while, and it was maybe a favor, and it would have been maybe an older director that maybe didn't get it, but could make something for them, you know, almost like taking, you know, someone and bringing them to the old school, like Kmart, you know, photo, you know, booth thing that they had there for families. Although Blink would probably do that, 'cause that's probably a funny gag to sort of do, but it wouldn't fit, you know. And for me, I was raised on just sort of independent films and cinema and, you know, music and indie movies and all that stuff. And so when I met those guys, it just sort of clicked. I mean, we were the same age, and we were wanted to do stupid, funny stuff. And, but at the same time thought that we could somehow make something really, really cool. So that energy, just, again, it just fit. And the fact that they had the drive to go beyond that, you know, I got to ride those coattails, but at the same time, I had to want to go beyond that as well. You know, so it just worked from an opportunity standpoint, you know, and it's all super, it's still super punk rock and underground. And that gave me really a taste for how the underground does eventually become the mainstream. Like mm-hmm. it's one weird thing that comes from all my years of doing that. It was sort of developing some level of pattern recognition that all culture starts with a subculture.
Yes. Yeah, I can totally see that. And you can actually see it in your later work as you develop. And we'll get into that later in this interview. I'm going to bring that up later too, because I definitely want to talk about Jesus Christ in this, sure. in this interview with you, you know. But
love that.
So the what does it do to the mind? I'm just so curious.
Yeah.
To know that over 2 billion views of your work collectively have been seen on YouTube alone. Now, that's just YouTube. You can imagine if you tally it up. What does that do to the mind, knowing that that many people have just viewed your work?
You know, I don't know if I've ever thought of that. You know, when it was just MTV, that felt like something, because that, in a weird way, was bigger than YouTube.
Mm-hmm.
Billions and billions of views on YouTube. MTV, you felt that. You know, when in 1992 or 93, MTV started putting directors' names on the music video.
Yes.
Just, you know, MTV at that point, I mean, that's bigger than the internet in the sense that everyone is watching MTV, and it was, you know, band, song title, record company, director. So mm-hmm. there you are. You're immediately slotted with something. Is that's as big as it gets. You know, I remember mid-90s, late-90s. I mean, I couldn't go through a mall without some kid coming up from Hot Topic, running out, wanting to get an autograph or buying something and pulling my ID out when they used to check your ID with a credit card back in the day.
Yes.
They'd look, you remember that? You look up, they'd say, "You're Darren Doan? Wait, I know this name." So that was, I felt that was wild.
Mm-hmm.
Where now 2 billion views, 20 billion views, you can't really get a sense of it.
Mm-hmm.
So I've never thought of it in those terms. But I think what became weird for me is once YouTube sort of exploded, I saw the immediate chain of how quickly I could see somebody's work and then steal it, and how quickly I could do something and someone could steal it, which I love. You know, I love seeing,
yeah,
okay, oh, I'm going to do that. But I was shocked at how quickly little things I had done that I thought were just, you know, were sort of my thing, immediately people were doing. And I was like, oh, wow, this is crazy. So
yeah, it very is cool.
Wild.
Trendsetter, definitely a trendsetter. You certainly were. So,
but by the way, I was more of a trendsetter in a very, let's say it was, I just wanted to get things done. So a lot of the things that I ended up setting some minor trends in were just things that were just really punk rock. Like just take the camera and go, put a band mm-hmm. in a room, you know. My lighting was never perfect. I was never trying to have this consistent, you know, look and feel throughout my music videos. It was, you know, I was in
it was raw. It was raw, yeah, like punk.
Just raw, because that was, I wanted to create at the speed of thought. So mm-hmm. my, you know, my stuff was, I think more of the trends that I may have been a part of were much more about, process, right? It was just mm-hmm. much more about how to get things going as opposed to this sort of sexy finishing stuff in different lenses or different cameras and stuff like that.
Yeah. So here's a question. And I'm just very curious. Did you do the video for Shinedown, Second Chance?
No. And there's a really interesting story with that, because when that album comes out, I get the call. At the time, I had sort of become the guy that was doing a lot of stuff for Atlantic Records.
Mm-hmm.
And I had gotten a call. I had done the Jason Mraz music video, because Jason didn't want to do a music video. And I had a little bit of a history of being able to work with difficult artists. Now, mm-hmm. I don't think they're difficult, but labels sometimes can have an issue or can have because they just have a certain vision or whatever. Anyways, I do the Jason Mraz, I'm Yours video.
Which was huge, by the way. Huge.
Massive, right. But he didn't want to do that. And I'd gotten on the phone and said, why? He said, because I've only got 1 week for a vacation. I'm going to be touring for 2 years on this album. I have to take this vacation. And I said, well, where are you going? He said, Mexico. I said, I have a lot of friends in Hawaii. What if you just went there? And what if I just gave you a vacation and documented the vacation and made that the music video? He said, oh, I'm in. Which is a whole other story. But Atlantic Records, I developed, like, he could work with kind of complicated, difficult artists. And then that became, hey, Zach Brown, have him, you know, hey, Shinedown. Hey, and all of a sudden, I get on the phone with Shinedown, and we shoot video for a song called Devour. But at lunchtime, I look over at this corner in the soundstage where we were in a building. There was this really weird wall. And I said, we should shoot another music video right now at lunch against that wall. I think it'd be great. And that was for a song called Sound of Madness. So we shot two videos that day. It just, the videos take off. They just, they're huge. And this will happen a lot. I was a little more under the radar. Now the album blows up. And all of a sudden, because I never had an agent or a rep, you know, or a manager or a lawyer, everyone starts jockeying for a position once a band really takes off. And so that's happened most of my career, that when things go, all of a sudden everyone gets in front of me, which right. is just, I've gotten used to it. And Second Chance comes, they do, I don't direct that one, and it becomes, you know, their biggest song.
Mm-hmm.
But I remember right after that, when the next album came, because I ended up doing every, this is weird, I ended up doing, like, you would think biggest song, keep going with that director, right?
Mm-hmm. Right.
The next album, I do every music video on the album. And I think the album after that.
Yeah.
And so that's one of those things that is always an interesting reminder, because Sound of Madness, the video we did at lunch,
mm-hmm.
because of that video, ended up actually kind of being the cult favorite to the fans.
Right.
And so Second Chance was obvious. That was the big ballad rock hit. But man, Sound of Madness did something totally different for them. And that stuck sort of in the gears of Shinedown and Brent Smith, the singer, who kind of really makes those creative decisions. And because of that, I didn't get Second Chance, but I probably got 5 more years of just rolling with them, doing so much stuff. So it's interesting, the chess moves.
Yeah, it really is. And the reason I asked is because it didn't look like you. That's why I was very curious. I was like,
yeah.
It's so weird because the other videos do and this yeah. video doesn't. And I was like, no. why did you change? But you didn't, because you didn't do it.
No. You know, wow. And by the way, I'm glad I didn't do that video, because they needed that video.
Hmm.
My work would not have done that for that video. That song, that radio hit, it needed someone other than me to make it exactly what it needed to be.
Mm-hmm.
By the way, that success afforded me
right
additional success. So, you know, as an artist, you know, I think we have to be looking at, especially as Christians, you really have to take some sort of providential look at
yes. all
stuff and be trusting God, like that guy. And by the way, and that guy was making a living on that video, and he went and did great things, and he's paying his mortgage and putting his kids through school. I mean, that's how God works, right? That's
yes.
That wasn't mine. They didn't owe me anything. Like that. Mm-hmm. I love seeing that blessing just overflow.
Yeah, that's. I'm glad that you think like that, and I'm glad that you mentioned as being Christians.
Let me ask you something: is your soap doing its job, or is it just pretending to be clean while secretly plotting to dry out your elbows? Be honest, if your soap came from a gas station or smells like floor cleaner, we need to talk. Halfback Mountain Soaps is what happens when real people say, hey, what if soap didn't suck? No harsh chemicals, no weird aftersmell, just shea butter, coconut oil, olive oil, and real essential oils that smell like actual things, like lemongrass and mountain streams, not cool power surge or Arctic wolf explosion. And when you order 5 bars, they throw in a free wooden soap dish, because nothing says fancy like a bar of soap on a little wooden throne. Free shipping if you spend $75, which is just a couple days worth of coffee you spilled on yourself anyway. So go to halfbackmountainsoap.com and smell like a person and not like regret.
So when I interview people and ask for testimonies, I always ask them the same question. I usually lead off with that, but I was really excited about your work. I know a lot about your work, so I wanted to talk to you a little bit about that. But the first question I normally ask is, to the best of your ability, could you tell me your earliest memory of when you heard the name Jesus Christ?
Yeah. I mean, I don't really remember when I heard it, but my first memory with Jesus, I must have been 7 or 8 years old. I was in a garage at a beach house, and I was looking at my mother, and the scene just starts, and I say, I want to accept Jesus into my heart.
Hmm.
Now, I don't remember anything after that.
Yeah.
I have moments where I remember being at a couple churches and then nothing.
Mm-hmm.
And so there's just this, the scene just goes black. And Jesus was never talked about. It was never brought up. There was no religion. I mean, we were culturally Christians. I mean, we're celebrating Christmas and Easter. I mean, we weren't Muslims, you know, so right. Doing American Christian things. But nothing was ever brought up ever again. Like, that was it. And so it's not until I'm doing all these music videos that a business acquaintance says, there's all these Christian bands that are really good, but they can't get on MTV because they're Christian. But if they could get you to do one of their videos, that would probably at least allow them to talk. Because again, back to like, that's how big of a deal it was,
mm-hmm,
to be an MTV music video director. If you were doing hit videos, like, that was something that could get you in the door. Hey, we're going to get Darren Doan to do the video. Or he did the video. And sure, mm-hmm, that worked. That was MXPX. And next thing you know, I'm with Tooth and Nail Records, doing a ton of videos, and I'm around all these Christians, and no one is sharing the gospel with me. No one is saying anything. No one's telling me he's got a plan for my life. No one's calling me a sinner. They're all smoking cigarettes and drinking beer, and, you know, and no one says a word, but I'm always at these like Christian music festivals and events, and I'm hearing people preach from like the stage, and I'm hearing just weird things. And, I was always watching TBN. I was just fascinated with Benny Hinn and Jesse Duplantis. And like, I would just watch televangelists. Like, it was really a weird thing. And then on a whim, talking to the president of Tooth and Nail Records, and he just happened to mention Mere Christianity. And then he had to get off the call for some reason. When I drove home that day, I stopped by the bookstore, found it. And
C.S. Lewis, Mere Christianity. Yeah.
Yeah. And
wow,
found the book. I was looking for Mirror, M-I-R-R-O-R.
Uh-huh. Mirror.
Right. And found Mirror. Okay. And my dad's house was near the Barnes and Noble. So I just drove to my dad's house and sat down in his living room, started reading. I think I got a couple paragraphs in, and I think he mentioned something about line cutting. Like, why do we know something's wrong if someone cuts in front of us or something? And I just put the book down. I was like, oh my goodness, I'm a line cutter. I said, I'm not going to read this book. And it just kept gnawing at me. It was really intense. We don't have enough time for the intensity, but it was intense. And I went back like a week or two, picked the book back up. I got maybe a chapter or two in, and I don't think he ever mentions hell, because I never picked it up again. That's how sort of frightening of an experience that book was to me. But I'm sure he never mentions hell. And but I remember thinking, if there is a hell, I deserve it. Like, and I was like, okay, I need to go and have a conversation with God, and went up to this sort of mountain, not a mountain, but like a hill you could hike up to at the place where I was living, which is funny thinking of like Jim Jordan typology. Here I go to meet with God, right? I'm going to go have a meeting with God up on a mountain, right? Like we need to have a conversation.
Right. It's like a Charles Ingalls moment from Little House.
Oh, yeah, exactly. went up and just started having this conversation with God. And it was really one of the only, I think I've only had two really wild experiences that I wouldn't even try to argue were real in one sense. Like it doesn't fit my theology. Like, you know, I've only had two like wild moments. And that first one was, I just kept saying, Lord, I want to have a relationship with you, but like, I don't want to call myself a Christian. Christians seem weird. And I don't want to, say Jesus Christ is my Lord and Savior and I deserve hell and please forgive me for my sins. Like, I don't want to do that, you know? And I was sitting on this like little, cause there was like a bench, this little table up there on this, you know, I think it was like a hiking trail thing at the top there. And I was sort of praying with my head down. And then he just picked me up. I remember just, you know, again, I don't believe this happened. So if anyone wants to say it didn't, I'm fine with that. He just picked me up. I mean, I just levitated. He just picked me up and just threw me down to my knees.
Mm.
I accept Jesus Christ as my Lord and Savior. Like, you're King. Like, I want to be forgiven of my sins. Like, I just went and I just was like, oh no, what did I just do?
Yeah.
And everything was gone. The guilt I had felt, the sort of evil I had known I'd been a part of and was championing, and it left. And yet I had this really weird feeling like it was still a part of me, but it wasn't going to kill me.
Right.
And there's no theology yet. There's no thinking through any of this stuff yet. And I said, okay, I'm going to go home. I'm going to read my Bible, but I'm not going to tell anybody.
Mm-hmm.
It's the only time I'd ever heard something audible. And I just heard God say to me, no, you're not cool anymore. And the next part, just to this day, like when I reflect on it, just cuts me. He said, because the way he said it, he said, and you're going to tell everybody about me.
Yeah.
And I was like, oh, which just basically means you're about to become a complete a-hole.
You're going to be a weirdo now, just like those people. You're going to be
arguing, debating. You're just going to be the most annoying human.
Right.
You know, my horoscope. Oh, let me tell you about horoscope. Ruining everybody's day, like, just, you know. So but that's how it starts.
How old were you at that point?
I'm born in 72. I graduated high school at 90, so I'm 18 in 1990, and this has got to be 96 97.
Oh, so this is after you had already started with Blink.
Again, maybe that's the context of God saying, you're not cool anymore. I mean, I was as cool as it got. Like, I was the guy, you know? And, you know, that began what would be just a complete upending of my entire life. Like, the next years are just horrible.
Can you give me some highlights to that? Like, what do you mean by that?
I was married. My wife left. I was bankrupt then within a few months after that. I was a weird, crazy Christian. No one wanted to work with me anymore. So I didn't have a really career anymore. It was just all gone. And I was moved back into my dad's house, sleeping bag on a bed on the floor, and trying to figure out, like, wow, how do I do any of this now, you know? And it didn't help that I was, you know, there was only sort of Calvary Chapel style churches around me, and you know, they didn't want me in there because the Word of Faith movement was really exploding. Ironically, all that Benny Hinn stuff I was watching, I'm watching the Vineyard movement from Malibu, like really explode and come over into the area where we were. And everything is just gnarly. What, you know, you got people doing these church events and they're doing big jugs, you know, big things of water, and they're doing water readings and forecasting in the spirit. Like, just, you know, I'm saying, like, guys, this is not good stuff. You want to be involved in this? So, like, all my non-Christian friends hate me. All this Christian community hates me. And it was like, man, I got, you know, there was an issue with the Trinity. There was a whole thing going on with, like, Benny Hinn. He saw that God was nine, not three, and all this stuff. And, you know, like, there was, you know, I was like telling people, like, yeah, you probably don't want to get involved in that stuff, you know, this, you know. And then it was like, you should probably leave, you're argumentative, you know. And then it just was like, I got no church life, I got no work life, I got no friends. It just was like, oh my goodness, like where do you go? Like, Jesus, like, why would you do this to me? Like, this is horrible.
Yeah. I want you to forgive me of all my sins, and I want you to come into my life, and then your life gets upended.
Yeah. Like, just, I mean, just horrible. Like, just was just like, it was insane. And, you know, by God's grace, you know, one of the kids, young kids that was in a Bible group I was in, who sort of saw it all go down and saw the whole thing, I ran into him. I was drowning my sorrows, I think, like, in a double beef and cheddar Arby's sandwich. And,
good choice.
Yeah, always. Yeah. And and he was like, Doan, he said, what are you doing? I said, oh, you know, it's like, there's a little church I found across from the high school in town in a strip mall. And I went in, I met the pastor. Anyways, he had all these books behind him. And I saw, like, Bonson and DeMar and Van Til and Greg Kokel. He goes, those are those guys you were, like, always talking about. He goes, because you should go meet them. And I was like, and I was ready to walk away. I was like, I was done. I was like, this whole Christianity thing, you know, like, you know. So I just drove over that moment, and I walked in the strip mall, and I met the pastor. It was called The Sanctuary, a guy named Robert Campbell. And I was able to talk to someone like the stuff, like, orthodoxy was normal.
Yeah.
And, you know, he wasn't, you know, he wasn't, I mean, he was, he had all that stuff. He was red, you know, he came out of MacArthur Seminary or school. I forget the masters. But he knew everything. He knew Francis Schaeffer. He knew the story. He got it. You know, like, it wasn't like I didn't need someone to agree with me, but it was just so nice to talk to someone that, like, yeah, I know theonomy. Here's why I'm not a theonomist. You could have a conversation. You know, like, I'm not full, you know, presuppositional. I'm more of a Francis Schaeffer presuppositionalist. You know, like, you know, I could just, like, oh my goodness, like, you could breathe, and it wasn't weird. Had it not been for that moment, I don't know what would have happened, but that was my lifeline, really, to this day. That moment is what got me over the hump. And I had Christian fellowship and community and some pastoral maturity. And that really got me to where I am.
So this Pastor Robert Campbell in the sanctuary in a strip mall was the lifeline, and have this, and you literally went to a sanctuary and got what you needed.
Yeah. Right. And of all things, a suburban strip mall, right? Yeah. Like, my life, a suburban punk kid, like, a, you know, like, it was next
perfect
pizza. Like, it's just, the story's fantastic.
All right, here's my secret. I've been pretending to be a kitchen genius. You know, pans clanging, timers dinging, me yelling stuff like, chef's kiss. But in reality, it's all thanks to my secret ingredient. So let me break it down for you. First up, everything seasoning. And yes, I mean everything. And it delivers. Chicken, nailed it. Fish, incredible. Veggies, now there's your chef's kiss. Mashed potatoes, don't even get me started. And look, I've even pushed the limits with this stuff. I sprinkled it on popcorn. Amazing. I even tried it on squirrel. Do I regret it? Absolutely. Trust me, everything seasoning makes everything better, whether you're cooking gourmet or going a little off-road. Now, the main event, steakhouse seasoning. This isn't just seasoning, it's grill dominance in a jar. You hit a steak with this stuff, and suddenly you're channeling your inner Hank. Who's Hank, you ask? Hank's that flannel-wearing, boot-stomping, truck-driving king of the grill. He can chop down trees with his bare hands and grills a T-bone so good you'll want to slap Gordon Ramsay's mama right in the mouth. I grilled burgers with Steakhouse last weekend, and my buddy goes, "Man, I really need this recipe." And I shot him. No, I just told him that I'd leave it in my will. So if you're ready to cook like a legend and keep your secret weapon close, head to MySecretBlends.com. That's www.MySecretBlends.com. And use code Burrows, that's B-U-R-R-O-S, at checkout for 20% off of your first order. So shake it, serve it, and when they ask you, just smile and say, "It's my little secret." My secret ingredient. Get it today at www.MySecretBlends.com and use Burrows to get 20% off of your first order.
Yeah. So from there, now you're back. You're not necessarily perfectly on track, but you met somebody that you can talk with. It was a lifeline for you.
Yeah.
So I'm very curious, like, take me from there. I know we have short time. I've only got another 20 minutes with you here, but I just want to, because I definitely want to talk about Collision. I want to talk about Gary Amar and Doug Wilson. So take me from there to up to, let's say, Collision.
Yeah. I meet a great woman, and she really architects like how I'm going to get back on my feet without it being some like plan, but she just was like, you know, she took a chance that, you know, like there was no reason to take a chance on me. I was not looking like a good investment, you know? And she did, and she got my mind starting to think more in terms of like what marriage is, family, kids, and how to really start like, oh, okay, there's something bigger here that we could be working towards. And she really got me, you know, there. And every time I was restarting my career, and it'd be like $1,000 music video I could pick up somewhere, and at some point she'd say, "Hey, you know, what if you don't take anything under $2,000? I'd be like, "Ah, I don't know about that." Okay. And then it'd be like, "Hey, maybe don't take anything under $5,000. Like, you know, like, "I think your work's great and you should do that. It's a lot of work." And, you know, and then 15, we laugh to this day, and don't take anything under $20,000. Don't take anything under $50,000. Don't take anything under $100,000. Next thing you know, it's a condo, then your first house, you say, like, kids, all that. And it's like all these things. I mean, she really, you know. And, but in that process of sort of then having a career again and having some big moments pop, and the next thing you know, the Jason Mraz thing pops up. That's because his manager used to be Blink's manager. So all these weird things start connecting again and all that. And then somewhere in there, I just kept thinking, like, how could I do something punk rock, like, with the stuff I enjoy, apologetics and just my faith and Christianity, and like, you know, and I thought I was going to read, I always wanted to redo the Bonson-Stein debate and have actors do it like it was a Lincoln-Douglas debate. And somewhere in trying to develop that idea, I think it was either Gary DeMar or maybe David Hagopian, and it said like, well, what if you had like, you know, Doug Wilson debate Christopher Hitchens? I think they're doing an exchange right now in Christianity Today. And it was like, that'd be interesting. And
that's metal. That is metal right there.
Yeah. And you know, I had enough. I was set enough to where I could take a chance on a project, spend some money, whether made anything or not. But I just kept thinking like, I want to do like the most punk rock. I remember thinking like, I wanted to contribute what I saw the equivalent of that bands did and movies did, could I make the first real punk rock something in like modern Christendom? I mean, I remember thinking about that, like, you know, like what would that look like? What would be the Nirvana Bleach album on Sub Pop of Christianity? So not even Nevermind, you know, later. I'm like,
right.
Well, it'd be like the, just the thing that, you know,
and the gritty.
Yeah. And the next thing I know is like, it was happening. And I knew once it started, like, oh, this is going to be wild.
Yeah.
I knew when I was editing it, I was just putting, you know, there was just me. So there was no studio, no investors, no nothing. It was just me sitting there going like, oh, I'm going to go to a heavy metal song here. I'm going to go to a hip hop song here. I mean, I knew, I was conscious every moment of every part of that edit going like, this is, you know, no, if I remember thinking when it was done, if I saw this film, I'd be so jealous. Like if someone made this other than me, I would be jealous.
Yeah.
Would be upset. So I was like, that was sort of like my goal. And we did it. There was a whole other story. I mean, I don't know. I mean, that became so punk rock because there was no real distribution. There's no internet yet, really. This is still try to get it on DVD and sell a DVD and see if, you know, like it was, you know, so it really was like a punk rock tape being passed around.
I know that, you know, I came in really late to the game, long after it had been done. And I went, and when I watched it for the first time, I was so enamored by the entire, just not only the two men, but how you captured it, the music, the cuts, the moves, the pans, the slides, the just the coloration.
Yeah.
It was such a beautifully done, and it really was punk rock Christianity. And I was jealous of the fact that you were able to sit in a room with Doug Wilson and Christopher Hitchens having a beer and talking.
Yeah.
And knowing that both of those men like Wodehouse and read him at different times, and I was like, and so do I, you know, and I was like, I would have loved to have been a fly on the wall, and you helped us be that, but I would have liked to have been able to talk. So you got to meet Christopher, you know, Chris Hitchens.
That was good. He became a good friend. We liked hanging out together. We liked partying together. Like it was, I mean, he's an absolute blast. He loved being around, you know, us. And he's a punk rock, you know, he was a punk rock dude. So, you know, you can tell when you're around people who want to get in trouble, you know, you can,
yeah.
And, you know, and when you're with Hitch, it was like, you know, just the energy was, how do we cause trouble?
Yeah.
Like that was the energy, you know?
Yeah.
It was, the moment he'd walk into that room, he'd have that look on his face like, let's go find trouble. I loved it. It was just the best experience, and we had a great relationship, and I loved taking shots at him, and he would always make fun of me because I would always ask the waiter, what do you recommend on the menu? And he hated that I did that. He would always say, you know, he'd say something like, he had a couple ways of saying it, but it was basically like, it showed that I had no free agency. I had no self-respect as a man, you know, that I had, you know, like he just would always say the fact that he's like, you know, you don't ask a waiter to recommend things, you know? And then I would usually respond with this coming from a guy with like a 1980s leather jacket who never played an instrument, you know, like, you know, he'd get a kick out of it, you know, and, you know, he'd say touche, you know, or something. And it would just be really funny. But you know, he's one of those guys where, you know, being on the road with bands, you need people that have an energy of like, let's keep going. Let's get after it. Let's make something. He had that energy.
Mm-hmm. That was honestly in that, it was, our mutual friend, Gary DeMar.
Yep.
Had, you know, he's put out information about Collision, you know, over the years through American Vision. And that's really where I learned about it. And I've had a few conversations with him about it, about that movie in particular, and how that, you know, that moment where, you know, Hitchens and Wilson are talking, and Wilson tells Hitchens, you know, oh, well, that was something that, you know, took place in 70 AD due to the Roman Empire. And it was such a shock to him. And I remember it being a shock to me.
Interesting. Okay.
You know, at the time. And I was just like, oh, like that didn't even cross my mind.
Yeah.
And Gary DeMar was a huge part also with Last Days Madness for me. Yeah. I mean, it was just a culture shock for me because I grew up, you know, dispensationalist. So hearing Doug Wilson and Hitchens talk about that, it was really revolutionary for me. And I was like, oh, okay, I need to read some more. I need to learn more here. So, and now that we're talking about Doug Wilson too, something you said really resonated with me earlier about how do we get in trouble, or it really resounds with the way that you work or like your films. Stonewall, it's such a shocking thing. Like when you watch Stonewall and like even the way that you question, you know, Wilson, you kind of went at him, you know, I don't know if that was planned, but you went at him, you know, and he, you know, like in regard to the Civil War was, you know, why did the Civil War end? I remember you weren't really attacking him, but you were trying to get a straight answer. And
yeah,
I just admire Wilson's ability to stay in the moment and to, you know, to be congenial, but also to be, you know, true.
He
and
better look, you know, for all the things you'll say about Doug, he's such a softy. And yeah, if you don't push him, you know, I find Doug very boring if you don't push him.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Because he's not going to say more than, I mean, he's so respectful in that sense. And, you know, I remember during Collision, we're at Columbia University and he gave a whole talk and he just was like, oh, like, you know, I know the movie. But afterwards, all the students come up and they start going after him. And man, they just kept pushing him and pushing him. And, you know, like, well, Kierkegaard said this. He said, well, no, Kierkegaard actually says this. And if you need to swallow the reductio with it, but he just got, because the more they went after him, the more they went after him. It just was like, wow. So I know with Doug, if you don't push him, I live in Moscow. I've been in some big events. And you look around, and you're like, he's just in the corner, no one talking to him. He's not trying to make conversation. It's just sitting there like no one wants to talk to him. He's that humble. So I know you have to push him.
Again, in that movie Collision, you definitely see Hitchens pushing him a little bit, and he's rock solid. Like, he is so in the moment and ready for it.
Yes. He loves it. He loves it. I mean, it was, you know, I could see him get giddy sometimes when Hit started turning it up.
Yeah.
You know, like I was like, I could see, you know, he likes that, you know. He's not going to throw the first punch, but man, he's ready for the follow-up.
Yeah, for sure. And you know, his blog and May blog is pretty spicy at times. It's pretty good.
Yeah. And that's, you know, I mean, that's just a different Doug.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, I'm still shocked how many people read it. I'm still shocked how many people think they know what the words are that he's writing. You know, I have to still go and look up words every time I read something, you know.
Oh, same right here. You got to have a dictionary.
His blog's not accessible. It's like, it's, you know, for the common guy, like it's not, you know, like, so I'm always amazed when people are like, his blog, I'm like, I'm still deciphering things from things that.
Isn't it brilliant though? It's brilliant though. His work is incredible.
I think between the Bontz and Stein debate, learning that early on in my walk, under what that was, and then Doug Wilson's blog, those two things were an education. And just, wait, how do you read this? What is he saying? What argument? What is that? Like, looking up words. I mean, I think between those two things, it really has been an education.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I know. And one of the things, and I'm not trying to stir up anything, but you obviously do fine in spicy topics, but whenever Gary DeMar got on the hot seat and got in hot water over some of the things that he said, he had said to me, and he said publicly, that you had actually reached out to him, you know, as a friend, just to talk to him.
Yeah.
And recently, I guess it's been a few months back, I saw like you did another video with him talking some more. And I just want you to know that I appreciate the fact that you're still that person that is open enough to talk. Kind of like what you looked for in Robert Campbell at the Sanctuary to be able to talk. You've done the same thing for someone like Gary DeMar. And I think I think that's wonderful to be able to talk. He's asking some very hard questions, but I think So I think some people need to defend him a little bit. He's worked really hard to become Uncle Gary. He didn't become Uncle Gary without decades of service, you know?
Yeah. No, I think it's a really interesting, there's a narrative playing out right now that, when you look at yourself as the center of the world, because our own personal narratives is where we're all rooted, right?
Right. Yeah, of course.
And, you know, I think it's Gary DeMar that had told me, even to go to the moon, you have to build all the physics and the math around the Earth being the center of the world,
mm-hmm.
or else you can't get back.
Yeah. Right. So, right.
You know, you can laugh at people thinking, oh, the ancients thought the Earth was the center of the universe. Well, first of all, we actually don't know. It could be. Like, that's the, like, it could, technically, we don't know where the Earth is, you know.
Right.
But to do math equations, get to the moon and back, you have to assume you're the center.
Mm-hmm.
And in my own life, I have only gone from one controversy, fight, controversy, underground subculture, becoming mainstream event after the next. And when I got to be around Doug Wilson, I was like, oh, like, this is the next thing. He's the next thing. I knew he was the next thing. Like, I have pattern recognition of what's going to be the thing that's going to rule culture. And so when I met Doug, I was like, oh, this is the most important pastor in the world.
Mm.
Like I know that. And he's proven that. Might be a low bar, but he's proven that.
Mm-hmm.
And the controversy right now around Gary, I think is the most important conversation of what is going to be the next iteration of Christianity. Because that comes on the heels of the internet and AI and people being able to do work and research that, you know, 10 years ago, you know, I was talking to a friend of mine, you know, Oxford grad, he goes, you know, 10 years ago, I had to go to that library to look at that. It's in my pocket now. So from 10 years ago and all back, whenever that library was, that's how you read that. That's how you got that information. I can see exactly what Augustine wrote. I can see exactly how weird of a dude Augustine is when I start doing research now and I'm looking at stuff and I'm saying, well, why didn't the church adopt these 10 other things from Augustine?
Mm-hmm.
Right. Like I can, and then I can ask that question. Where we are at right now from a scholarship standpoint, it is completely punk rock. The mainstream evangelical hierarchy, especially from a scholarship standpoint, is in absolute trouble. And what they don't realize is they're already done.
Mm-hmm.
They're already irrelevant.
Right.
And the tension is going to be between the everyday person in church who the herd has been protected by everyone that's gotten an A on the test and knows all the rules. And that's whether you're a Calvary Chapel dude or whether you're over here full Eastern Orthodox, whatever. Everyone's pretty much agreed on the rule. And the answer is, I don't know why people are arguing and fighting. This just seems silly. I don't know why it matters and all that. Well, you have the freedom because there's all these people at the top, church leaders, the teachers, the philosophers, the scholars, all that. They've already agreed to a certain set of rules that have been fought over and continue to fight over. But what's happening now is the everyman, the sort of punk rock nature of theology and philosophy and typology and all these things, is now in the hands of a much bigger group of people.
Mm-hmm.
And interestingly, much like punk rock, they actually know how to communicate to everyone around them.
Mm-hmm.
And the people at the top are going to try to come down and now really, okay, maybe now we'll try to explain to you the hypostatic union. Maybe now we'll try to come down and explain kenosis. Maybe now we'll sort of talk about, you know, and the everyday person's like, well, yeah, but my buddy Johnny already did that. And I think he's making a really good case. We are going to go through a crazy, I think, transformation of what theology looks like in the next decade.
Yeah, it's an upheaval. It certainly is.
Do you ever feel like your soap is doing more harm than good? Well, I did too. Then I found Halfback Mountain Soaps. Born from one person's search for a better bar of soap, these are as pure as a mountain stream. No chemicals, no drying agents, just simple, skin-loving ingredients like shea butter, olive oil, coconut oil, and castor oil. Each bar is handcrafted and scented naturally with things like lavender, cinnamon spice, and sweet lemongrass. Here is a great tip. Grab 5 bars, and they will toss in a handcrafted wooden soap dish too. That dish helps your soap last longer because it dries out between uses. With free shipping on orders over $75, it's easy to stock up or give them as a gift. Take a deep breath, scrub with something real, and feel the difference. Visit halfbackmountainsoap.com today and bring the mountain into your bathroom. Also, you can use code BURROWS10 and get 10% off of your first order.
And so that brings me to one of my final points I wanted to ask you about is, so what are you up to these days? Are you going to make us a documentary that documents how this happened and what's about to take place?
I would like to. Yeah. I mean, it's definitely my goal at this point.
I mean, you've got the finger on the pulse. I really think you do.
Yeah. I mean, that's why I was talking to Stone, because I was like, look, it's, you know, as soon as I do anything in this world, I'm losing money.
Mm-hmm.
Right. Cause there's no one funding me, you know? And so the time and attention I'd like to put towards this, because I think the story, I think if you don't understand Augustine to now, because I think you have to do that. I think you have to understand Augustine. This is my pitch. You have to understand Augustine. You have to understand theologically the disagreements and the agreements on what the heck happened in the garden.
Mm-hmm.
Because it doesn't matter. Even everything going on right now with preterism and partial preterism, that still has a, and this is my every sort of every man approach, but all that is still being controlled by what happened in the garden.
Mm-hmm.
Now you got people like Tim Martin that would say, no, you got to go back to creation itself and have this conversation. And that's fair.
Yes.
But even that becomes more of a type, but there's an inversion of typology there. And that's still a little fancy, you know, and I love that stuff. However, whatever the heck happened in the garden, that's the controlling factor.
That's correct. It is.
That's everything. Who were Adam and Eve? Who's the serpent?
Yeah.
What is death?
Yes.
That's it.
Mm-hmm.
I don't care what issue you're dealing with. Everything is built around that controlling kind of garden hermeneutic. That controls everything. So you can't even get to these arguments now about the end and the resurrection and the body and all that stuff. I mean, you could do that. You line up your verses. I line up my verses. Okay. But to me, I'm still watching going like, oh, I know. But this still comes down to what the heck was death.
Yeah.
Like, okay, have at it, guys.
That's right. Our
solos. You know, hey, Mike Sullivan, keep putting your charts together. I love it. But guess what?
Mm-hmm.
It all comes down to what the heck happened in the garden. What was the relationship to God? Who was the serpent? What is the manifestation of that? Please work that out for me. Is that Lucifer embodying a snake and then left the snake? There's all these things, and that gets back to Augustine, and that gets to Origen and how we're reading scripture, all that. And then death, what is death? Was there death before the fall? How was that is the controlling hermeneutic. And so as much as I am going to, at some point, Lord willing, put this all together, maybe I'll put some sort of like GoFundMe campaign and, you know, so I could spend an actual year doing it, which I would love to do. But that to me becomes the most important controlling issue that needs to be dealt with.
I think that it would be brilliant. And I really hope that you do. And yes, put up a GoFundMe or crowdfund it.
Yeah.
Crowdfund it. I mean, there's going to be enough people that would like to hear this and to work through it, you know, I would say.
And I would love to do it. I don't know who the audience is specifically, but I think it's something I'm thinking a lot about, you know, again, providentially, you reaching out, watching someone like, you know, Zach Davis do the thing he's doing.
Mm-hmm.
Is it Davis? Yeah.
Yeah. Zach Davis.
Yeah. You look at his YouTube channel. I mean, I know it's Zach. I was confusing if I put the wrong name on Zach. I think it's just Pastor Zach. What he's doing, look at it, like 40,000 people following him now on his YouTube channel.
That's right.
Look, Zach is the most punk rock player in this game right now.
Yes, he is.
You know, I think you and Zach, when I think of like, when I think of brand identity, I think of you, and I've always thought of your podcast and what you do. Zach is the Nirvana.
Yes. He's going to take it to the next level, baby.
Zach is working on Nevermind right now, and this whole world is still hair metal.
Yeah.
still White Snake, you know.
Guns N' Roses.
Yeah, it's still like, you know, and Zach's sitting there and like, I'm looking at Zach going like, oh my goodness, like this dude, you know, like this guy's coming. But I think possibly like maybe connecting some of these and just really being like, hey, like maybe I crowdfund this, you know, like who wants to, you know, here's the goal. Here's what I'm looking to do. And yeah, I mean, that would be a dream project.
Well, I'll get behind it. The minute that you put it up, I will blast it.
And we have to follow up because I have so many questions for you and and what you're doing. So we have to do a follow up just off air because I need to really pick your brain because I'm fascinated with kind of what you've been doing.
Oh, well, thank you. I just want you to know how much I appreciate you sitting down with me. I know you got to go do stuff with your kids. I say amen to that.
I got football practice.
That's amen to that. I say go be with them. It's wonderful. That's what it's all about.
Yes, sir. Yes, well, sir.
So Darren Doan, thank you so much for being with me. And I can't wait for everybody to hear this. And let's definitely have that follow-up call one day and we'll just chat.
Send me an email. Let's do a follow-up tomorrow.
Sounds great.
Okay.
Thanks a lot, Darren. You take care.
Thanks to your audience and everyone listening. Really appreciate it.
Yes, sir. Thanks.